So we're going to pick up where we left off, which is in 1 Samuel chapter 30. Lord willing, we'll finish another book tonight. I feel so accomplished when we finish a book, you know? One of these nights we're going to come in and we're going to be starting, I'm going to say, tonight we start the book of Psalms, and then it'll be like, oh, because you know you'll be in there forever. So while we're cranking these books out, that's a good thing. 1 Samuel chapter 30. Starts out this way. It says, and it came to pass, when David and his men were come to Ziklag on the third day, that the Amalekites had invaded the south and Ziklag, and smitten Ziklag and burned it with fire, and had taken the women captive that were therein. They slew not any, either great or small, but carried them away and went on their way. David, if you were here, if you weren't, then maybe you don't remember, but David is in Philistine territory. He is there for the wrong reason. He got nervous and had a little internal struggle and decided that Saul's going to get me if I stay here, and he went to Philistine country, went to Achish, the king of Gath, the city that Goliath was from, and asked him for a place to stay. He gave him Ziklag. He and his 600 men and their families went to Ziklag. And then he went on raiding parties and stuff, and he raided some of the other lands around. He didn't raid Israel, though. He told Achish that he was raiding Israel to make Achish think that he was fighting against Israel, but he wasn't. But he wasn't supposed to be there. He's in the wrong place. Well, it came to pass that the Philistines were going to war. We read that last time. And they were going to go to war against Israel. And Achish told David, time to pay the piper. Be assured, you're going to fight with me. Which means that the anointed king of Israel, although he hasn't taken possession of the throne, was set up because of his disobedience to be fighting against Israel. And it seems from everything we read that he intended fully to do it, which would have just been wrong. But the Lord restrained him from doing that. All of the other leaders of the Philistines said, there's no way that we're going to fight with David behind us, because he's just going to take this as an opportunity to get right with Saul by killing us from behind. So no way. He's not fighting. If we're going to fight, he can't be here. So he got sent home, and the Lord's hand obviously in it. And so they're coming back from that. When we come to this section, it says, it came to pass when David and his men were come to Ziklag on the third day. It's about a 75-mile march. So you imagine walking 25 miles a day or marching 25 miles a day. And they're coming up on home. They've been away for a little while. They've been missing their families. They're looking forward to getting back into the comfort and the safety of Ziklag, walled city. And they see smoke in the distance, only it's not smoke like a campfire smoke. It's smoke like a burning city smoke. And come to find out, it says the Amalekites had invaded the south in Ziklag and smitten Ziklag and burned it with fire. The Amalekites, they show up on the scene when the Israelites are leaving Egypt. The Lord recorded this in Deuteronomy 25, verse 17. It says, remember what Amalek did unto thee by the way when thou were come forth out of Egypt, how he met thee by the way and smote the hindmost of thee, even all that were feeble behind thee when thou wast faint and weary, and he feared not God. Therefore it shall be, when the Lord thy God give thee rest from thine enemies round about in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance to possess it, that thou shalt blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. Thou shalt not forget it. The Amalekites came in behind the Israelites when they were leaving Egypt, and they attacked from behind, where the women, the children, the elderly, the sick would be dragging behind. That's where they came in and they attacked Israel. Joshua's first battle is going out against the Amalekites. And Amalek, pretty much throughout Scripture, is always a type of the flesh. You can look at what Amalek or the Amalekites do, the descendants of Amalek, and see what your flesh does, and it wants to attack you. And it always wants to attack when you're weak. It always wants to attack when you're tired. It always wants to attack when you're at your lowest point. And that struggle between Israel and the Amalekites is the same as the struggle that we face with the flesh. Galatians chapter 5, verse 17, Paul says, the flesh lusts against the spirit and against the flesh, and these are contrary one to another, so that you cannot do the things you would. There is that battle that goes on. You get saved, and some people become a Christian under the mistaken idea that once I'm a Christian, all of my problems are going to go away, and everything just gets easier. Well, no. Now you just have a fight on your hand. Before, your flesh, your desires ruled the day. There was no fight because they were in charge. It's when you turn around and the Lord saves you, now you have this battle that goes on, and it's like, well, I thought that all of this, I just wouldn't want that anymore. Well, you know, there's a war that goes on, and there's a fight that has to happen. And the Israelites were told, look, once you get into the promised land, I want you to wipe them out, completely destroy them. You can't leave them around. And for us, it's the same way. You want that flesh to go away, but that battle is still there. And Amalek, he passes off the scene for a while. It seems like he's almost wiped out. Then at one point, Saul was told that he was supposed to go find the Amalekites and destroy them. The Lord said, and I want you to wipe them out. I want you to take anything from them, burn everything that they have. You can keep no spoil from them, because it's a type of the flesh, and there's no good thing that comes from the flesh. Paul says, I know that in my flesh dwells no good thing. And Saul doesn't do it. He keeps the stuff for himself, and he leaves some of them alive. He says that he's killed all of them except for Agag. But here we have enough Amalekites on the scene within 20 years or so from then that they have enough to beat a city. I don't think Agag was that prolific before he got destroyed. And if you remember, the whole thing with Saul was he was king. He was told to do that. He didn't do it. Samuel the prophet shows up, and he says, oh, I did what I was supposed to do. I utterly wiped them out. And Samuel says, well, what's that bleeding of sheep? And, you know, why is it I hear that if they're completely gone? Oh, I kept them. I killed them all except for Agag. I kept him, you know. And Samuel tells him, the kingdom's going to be ripped out of your hand because you were disobedient. You were told to destroy the flesh. You were told to destroy Amalek. You didn't do it. And you've been disobedient. And he starts to walk away, and Saul grabs his shirt and says, wait. And he rips his shirt. And Samuel turns around and he says, in the same way that that's ripped, the kingdom's going to be ripped away from you. And then it's interesting, Saul, and it's a good picture of the type of guy he is, in 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 30. You remember what he said? Then he said, I have sinned. Yet honor me now, I pray thee, before the elders of my people and before Israel, and turn again with me that I may worship the Lord thy God. Notice it's the Lord thy God. So Samuel turned again after Saul, and Saul worshiped the Lord. And he says, well, everybody's going to know. So let's save some face, give me some respect in front of all the elders, and I know I've sinned, but just turn with me so that I can worship the Lord your God. And then he does whatever it is that he thinks worship is. And then Samuel gives him a little object lesson about what true worship is in verse 32, back in 1 Samuel 15. Then said Samuel, bring ye hither to me Agag, the king of the Amalekites. And Agag came unto him delicately. And Agag said, surely the bitterness of death is past. And Samuel said, as thy sword came, hath made women childless, so shall thy mother be childless among women. And Samuel hewed Agag in pieces before the Lord in Gilgal. And the proper way to deal with Agag, with your flesh, is to cut it in pieces, to crucify it, to put it to death. You can't nurse it around. You can't keep it hanging around as a trophy. It's got to go. And so now, partially due, of course, it's their disobedience, because David's where he's not supposed to be. But, you know, if Saul had done what he was supposed to do, they wouldn't be dealing with the Amalekites now. But yet the Amalekites showed up while they were gone, burned it with fire. And the truth is, they had left their families in the city of Ziklag, thinking this is a secure place, walled city, you know, yeah, we're in enemy territory, but, you know, it's no big deal, we'll just leave them there, everybody will be fine. And they took off and left the women and children alone in this city. And, you know, if we ever get to the point where we're living in the flesh, we're living in the land of our enemy, and we think that we can just leave the family behind and go live in disobedience to God and they're all going to be fine, what you'll find when you come back is that your place is burnt and your family is gone. They'll be captives of the flesh. I mean, that's what happens. And so they come back and everybody's carried away. Although it's interesting, because you can see God's hand in this. It says that the Amalekites slew not any, either great or small. If you remember back in chapter 27, when David was making his raiding parties into these other lands, he was killing everybody, man, women, children. He was a murderer and a thief. And he was wiping them out so nobody would tell that he was not really fighting against Israel. And the Lord, I think it's his mercy that he doesn't get the eye for eye justice that he probably deserves. And so David and his men came to the city. Behold, it was burned with fire, and their wives and their sons and their daughters were taken captives. Then David and the people that were with him lifted up their voice and wept until they had no more power to weep. And David's two wives were taken captives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail, the wife of Nabal the Carmelite. And David was greatly distressed, for the people spake of stoning him, because the soul of all the people was grieved, every man for his sons and for his daughters. But David encouraged himself in the Lord his God. It's interesting, you see this. He's at the bottom of the barrel, David is. He's lost his family, his wives. Of course, he's lost everything back through Saul. But now he finally gets to the place where everything's gone and he's got nobody to turn to. People want to kill him. And you can understand, if you lost your wife and your children and you look over and there's David, he led us here. What are you doing here? You know, why are we in this position? It's your fault. And they all want to kill him. And yet, look what it says, that little phrase in verse 6. David encouraged himself in the Lord his God. Even though he is backslidden, and even though he is in the enemy territory, God has not abandoned him. And he's going to come to his senses. He has to get to the place where he's completely wrecked and he's lost everything. It says David encouraged himself. Encourage, it means to take courage. You know, I think what happens is he learned what Paul learned in 2 Corinthians chapter 12. Verse 9, he said unto me, my grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. And then Paul goes on to say, most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities. I think David gets to the place where he realizes, now that I have absolutely no strength, there's no sense trusting in it. Now I'm at a place where I can't rely on myself, you know. I was having a discussion with my wife the other night. Men and women deal with things differently, or at least in general. I hate to stereotype, but the stereotypes are there for a reason. My experience has been, in general, men like to not think about it when there's problems. You know, they'll just ignore it. Maybe it'll go away. Women need to talk about it and talk about it and talk. And that's not for everybody, but that's a lot of people. They really want to discuss it and hash it out and think about it. And it's almost like you each look at the other one and think, why don't you understand? We need to talk about this. And the other one's thinking, don't you understand? If we just don't think about this, we won't have to deal with it, and we can go on with our life. And it's like, well, how can you compartmentalize that? I mean, that's so huge. And I, you know, we're looking at different things going on in our life, and I'm like, I was telling my wife, that one's easy. I can drop that one easy. How can you drop it? It's so big. And yeah, but there's nothing I can do about that one. I mean, I have nothing I can do. The ones that I can possibly have an effect on, I'll think about those and I'll mull them and I'll dwell and I'll try to work my way. But when you get to the place like David in a situation where, oh, I don't know what to do. Well, I guess that one's God, and you can just move right on. At least for me, you know, that's kind of how I work. And I think David gets to that point. And so he takes courage and he realizes, I am completely at the mercy of God. I can trust him. And he encourages himself. He takes courage. Notice that he encourages himself. He doesn't say, somebody needs to come cheer me up. They all want to kill him with rocks. I mean, he's got to do it himself. And I think there is a point where we need to do it ourselves, where we need to... I mean, he got into this mess by having a conversation with himself the wrong way. Remember back in chapter 27, the beginning of it, David said in his heart, I shall now perish one day at the hand of Saul. There's nothing better for me than I could speedily escape into the land of the Philistines. And he ignored what God had said. He ignored what Samuel, what his Abigail, what Saul, what Jonathan, what everybody had said, that you were going to be king, you're going to get through this thing, and instead had that conversation where he's like, eh, it's horrible, I better run away. Now, he has the right kind of conversation. He has a Psalm 42:11 conversation. Why art thou cast down, O my soul, and why art thou disquieted within me? Hope thou in God, for I shall yet praise him, who is the health of my countenance and my God. Hope in God. And he has that internal conversation where he says, shut up and believe what it says. Just believe what it says. You know, I think when it comes to counseling, a lot of us love to give advice. I hate to get it, but love to give it. Feel like we have so much advice to give. Oh, this is what you need to do. This is what you need to do. When in truth, we don't really know what anybody needs to do. I can barely even manage what I need to do. What I know is that the best counsel is You know, trust God. What's God said? Trust in God. And you know, that's tough to receive at somebody else's hands a lot of time. That's tough for me to say to somebody else, well, what does the Bible say? Well, this. Well, do you believe it? Yeah. Well, then trust God and move on, you know. But internally, I can say it to myself, and I don't like to say it to myself, but truthfully, that's the best conversation we could possibly have. Trust God. Trust God. Let him take care of it. He encouraged himself, and notice he encouraged himself in the Lord his God. He didn't do the self-esteem thing. He didn't say, I just got to look within myself because I'm better than this and I can be better and I can have my best life now and I think I can. He didn't do any of that, you know. Any guys ever watch that movie Nacho Libre? There's the one point before the big fight and Ramses is getting ready and there's some guy just sitting there rubbing his back saying, Ramsey's muscles are number one. Ramsey's legs are number one. Ramsey is... And you're thinking, that's so stupid. But yet, some of us, we like to watch the Ultimate Fighting, and there's this weird guy, George, and he's always like, tell me I'm strong. Tell me I'm powerful. Tell me I'm strong. And it's like, that's just so stupid. Who cares what I tell you? You know, there's only one person's words that mean anything, and it's the Lord's. And he's... What he's doing is he's remembering the word of the Lord. He's encouraging himself in the Lord as God. He says, and it's funny, when we get into Chronicles, and that's going to be a while away, in 1 Chronicles chapter 12, verse 19, it says at this point, there fell some from Manasseh to David, and he came with the Philistines against Saul to battle, but they helped him not. For the lords of the Philistines, upon advisement, sent him away, saying, he will fall to his master Saul to the jeopardy of our heads. As he went to Ziklag, there fell to him of Manasseh, Adnah, Jozabad, Jedidiah, Michael. There's a whole list of different people. As he's on his way back, all of these people are added to him. They go back. They go there with 600 men. They come back to Ziklag, and on the way, these other Israelites start showing up. And yet here, in 1 Samuel chapter 30, verse 6, David's not encouraging himself in the reinforcements. David's encouraging himself in the fact that God has promised that he's going to be king. And it's cool to see the way he reacts. Verse 7, 1 Samuel 30. David said to Abiathar the priest, Amalek's son, I pray thee, bring me hither the ephod. And Abiathar brought hither the ephod to David. And David inquired at the Lord, saying, shall I pursue after this troop? Shall I overtake them? And he answered him, pursue, for thou shalt surely overtake them, and without fail recover all. This is the first mention in 16 months that David has sought the Lord on anything. He went down after seeking his own counsel. He stays there for 16 months where he's not supposed to be. And it's good to see the contrast through these two chapters between Saul and David, because Saul, when he's scared and he's nervous, he goes and talks to a witch. When David finally gets to the place where he's broken and scared, he goes to seek the Lord, you know? And I guess the question is, whose will are you going to... I mean, Saul goes to the witch because he knows what God's will is, and he's not real thrilled about that, so he thought he'd try it a different way. David wants to know the Lord's will, and... he does that immediately. First thing, what do you want us to do? Now, personally for me, I'm thinking somebody just came, killed, you know, destroyed our city, took our wives and our children. I'm not thinking you got to spend a lot of time praying about, do you go after them? That seems like kind of a given to me. But yet David gets to the point where he says, no, I'm going to pray about absolutely everything. I've been reading this book by, it's an older one by E.M. Bounds on prayer and the preacher. And there's a bunch of quotes in it, and it's pretty devastating, actually, but here's one from John Wesley. I have so much to do that I spend several hours in prayer before I'm able to do it. I'm usually like, I got so much to do, I ain't got time to pray, I got to get on the road, I got to get to work. And here's what John Wesley saying, man, I got so much to do, I got to take a few hours and just pray about it. I have no hope of getting it done if I don't pray first. Crazy. Well, David gets to the place where he says, I'm going to ask God before I do anything. The reason why I'm in this problem is because I didn't ask him anything. Now I'm here. I know our wives are gone, our kids are gone. We're seeking the Lord. Bring the priest over here. What should we do? And, you know, I read stuff like that, and I got to ask myself, have I been seeking the Lord? Because I complain a lot of times about not seeking the Lord, you know, the Lord not speaking to me. But then the question is, well, how often do you actually ask him? Are you seeking the Lord? David sought the Lord. David inquired at the Lord, saying, shall I pursue after this troop? Shall I overtake them? And he answered him, pursue, for thou shalt surely overtake them, and without fail recover all. It's interesting. He's given something to do, and he's given a promise. He just asks, shall I go after them? And if I go after them, will I catch up with them at all? And yet, not only does he get the answer, you'll catch up with them, he gets an answer to something that he didn't even ask, which is, you're going to recover everything. You know, it says in Ephesians chapter 3, verse 20, now to him that is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power that works in us. Exceedingly abundantly above. You know, it seems like David, I'm sure, was at the point where he figured, I've blown it. I'm in enemy territory. I'm outside of the will of God. I was almost to the point where I was going to fight against God's people. I'm, you know, God's obviously brought these Amalekites in to take my stuff. I don't even dare ask if I can get them back. Just do we have a chance to revenge ourselves? Can we just, are we going to catch them if we go? And the Lord goes way above and says, not only are you going to catch them, you're going to get everything back. In verse 9, it says, David went. Okay, he went. He asked, he's given something to do, and a promise, so he does. And that's why David's a guy after God's own heart. Saul would ask and then not do. David asks and does. And he and the 600 men that were with him, and he came to a brook, Besor, where those that were left behind stayed. But David pursued, he and 400 men. For 200 abode behind, which were so faint that they could not go over the brook Besor. Everybody wants to kill David. They're mad at him. Their families are gone. Their kids, their wives, their kids. Their city is burnt. David's got them in the wrong place. They're complaining. And then David says, no, the Lord gave us a promise. I'm going to seek him first. I'm going to pray. Get the priest. Get over here. And the 600 guys are watching this. They're all crying. It says they cry to the point where they don't have power to weep anymore. They all watch this, and they see the old David come back. The old David used to be the guy that they followed because he was a godly guy, and he would seek the Lord about everything, and he wouldn't raise his hand against God's anointed. And then he'd fall into the place where he wasn't seeking God, and he was ready to fight against God's people. Now he's back. They all turn, and they're ready. Forget killing David. We can follow him. And all 600 go. They hit this brook, and of course, they'd marched 75 miles in 3 days, so they're all wiped out. They come home. Their families are gone. And they go, and you got to be thinking at this point, David's got to be seeing a little bit of the hand of God in this, because they had been turned away from fighting in the battle. If they had been able to fight with the Philistines, how long would it have been before they would have found out that their families were gone? Instead, they were sent back, and they get there right after it happens. So they get there, and by the time they hit the brook, and whether the brook is flooded to the point where they can't cross it or it's hard to cross, I don't know, but a third of his guys are wiped out. And so he leaves a third of them behind, and they keep going. And now David, if he was like me in this situation, he would be like, whoa, wait a minute. Adverse circumstances? Maybe God's not in this. We better stop. We better seek God again, because I've met some resistance. I mean, I know he said, go get them, but I just lost a third of my army. You know, that's not what you're looking for when you hear the Lord and you act on it. You're expecting, okay, downhill, here we go, smooth sailing. No, bang, I hit something. Well, if you're relying on your circumstances as a guide, as soon as you meet an obstacle, I guess I didn't hear from God after. No. David's like, okay, you guys aren't coming? Well, Lord said we're going to catch, so wait here with the stuff. We'll be back. And boom, they keep going. And it reminds me of that section with Gideon in Judges 7, where, you know, he uses Gideon, and Gideon's scared anyways, and then they're getting ready for the battle, and the Lord says to Gideon, you know, I don't think I can do it with your army, Gideon. You just got too many people. You got to send some home. You got to send. We got too many. And if I do it now, you're going to think you did it. So we best thin the herd a little bit. So tell anybody who's scared and wants to go home, they can go home. So they let all of the scared people go. And then God says, you know, that's better, but it's still too many. We better wipe it down. I'll tell you who to pick and who to keep. And he weeds it down to about 300 men. And it's the same thing here with David. 600 guys, and you're going to be fighting a big amount, but that's too many. We'll just leave a couple hundred behind with the stuff and keep going. And I like David. He's not surprised at adversity. He knows there's going to be tribulation. But yet he relies on the promise of God. He's got his word, and he's taking him at his word, and he's going, and it doesn't matter who falls off. David's going. If he's going to be the only guy showing up, David's going to make the trip because he's got a promise from God. And in verse 11, look at this. It says, they found an Egyptian in the field, and they brought him to David and gave him bread, and he did eat, and they made him drink water, and they gave him a piece of a cake of figs and two clusters of raisins. And when he had eaten, his spirit came again to him, for he had eaten no bread nor drunk any water 3 days and 3 nights. they're flying, they're on their way, they're pursuing, and here they run across this guy who's an Egyptian who's almost dead, left for dead. Now, it's not like the guy is just sitting there with a big sign saying, I will guide you to the people you seek if you help me. He's just a guy who's almost dead. He's not even an Amalekite. He's an Egyptian. And so but yet they stop. They stop and they help him out. And I think, you know, what's it say in Hebrews about entertaining angels? You know, don't be afraid to entertain strangers. He stops. He feeds the guy. He takes care of the guy, which he didn't have to do. And then he says to him in verse 13, David said unto him, to whom belongest thou? Who do you belong to? And that's a great question. You come to a question like that in Scripture and you want to ask yourself, who do I belong to? Whose am I? Whose are you? This guy, he says, I'm a young man of Egypt, a servant to an Amalekite. I come out of the land of the flesh and I serve the people of the flesh. And my master left me because 3 days ago I fell sick. Well, you know, that's not really all that surprising, because when you serve the flesh, you'll find that the flesh is a very cruel master. It always takes until it can't take anymore. You know, how many people do you know that die, they get into the pattern of serving their flesh, satisfying some need, whether it's drugs or alcohol or whatever, and it uses them up until they die. It just takes more and more and more and more. Well, this guy, he says he's a servant of Amalekite. He's going to say in verse 14, we made an invasion upon the south of the Cherethites, in verse 14, upon the coast which belongs to Judah and upon the south of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire. He was involved. He was serving those people. Romans chapter 6, verse 16 says, know you not that to whom you yield yourself servant to obey, his servants you are to whom you obey, whether of sin unto death or obedience unto righteousness. Whoever you're listening to, your actions show who you are. Not what you say, I believe this, or I think this, or I've learned this, or that doesn't mean anything. What do you do? Who are you serving with your life? If you say you have a relationship with Christ, but yet you're serving yourself continually, or you're serving sin or whatever, well, that's whose master you belong to. This guy was an Egyptian. David wasn't fighting the Egyptians, he was fighting the Amalekites, but because he was serving and doing the works of the Amalekites, one of their members. But he gives him some information. I was with them, we were ones who burnt Ziklag. And David said to him, canst thou bring me down to this company? And he said, swear unto me by God that thou wilt neither kill me nor deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will bring thee down to this company. And of course, David's seeing God's fingerprints all over this. And when he had brought him down, behold, they were spread abroad on all the earth, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil that they had taken out of the land of the Philistines and out of the land of Judah. They come and they're having a party with their stuff and their people. And David smote them from the twilight even unto the evening of the next day, and there escaped not a man of them save 400 young men which rode upon camels and fled. The word twilight, some places it's translated dawn. It seems like they waited until it was dark, like the beginning of the day, and just put the sword to them all day and all night, wiped them all out but 400 that gets away on camels. And check this out. David recovered all that the Amalekites had carried away, and David rescued his two wives. And there was nothing lacking to them, neither small nor great, neither sons nor daughters, neither spoil nor anything that they had taken to them. David recovered all. And David took all the flocks and all the herds which they drave before those other cattle and said, this is David's spoil. You know, God could have done it. David could have showed up and it could have been, you know, an angel had come down in the night and wiped them all out and just everybody dead. But he didn't. He allowed David and his men to be part of that battle. And the truth is, when we fight the flesh, we got to be part of the battle. You know, there's that thought that I'll just serve Jesus and he'll just make all of these desires go away and I'll be Joe or Susie Christian without any fight. No, I'm sorry, it doesn't work that way. We need to get dirty fighting the flesh. You guys know how it works. No pain, no gain. I mean, society tells us, well, they tell us you can buy a pill or a little electric shock machine you can put on your stomach and that'll make your abs look like a washboard. But truth be told, there's pain involved any way you look at it. All right, a pill isn't going to do it. We have to get dirty fighting the flesh. And David recovered all. David took all the flocks and the herds. And everybody's saying, this is David's spoil. This is David's stuff. Because David was responsible. You know, and truthfully, in our life, we should be the ones who say, this is Jesus' spoil. This thing in my life that was a battle that I couldn't win, Jesus led me into victory on it. This is Jesus' spoil. Nobody can boast in what we have done. It's all through his power. David being a type of Christ here. It says, and David came to the 200 men, which were so faint that they could not follow David, whom they had made also to abide at the brook Bezor. And they went forth to meet David and to meet the people that were there with him. And when David came near to the people, he killed them all for being lazy and weak. And oh, it doesn't say that. It says he saluted them. I'm sure they're probably expecting that, you know, that we got left behind because we weren't strong enough to go the whole way. And yet, look what David does. He salutes them. Now, there are other people who would treat him that way. Then answered all the wicked men and the men of Belial, or the worthless ones. Interesting to note that even in David's kingdom, there are wicked ones and worthless ones. And you've been in the church long enough, you'll find out there's wicked ones and worthless ones in the church. Of those that went with David, and they said, because they went not with us, we will not give them aught of the spoil that we have recovered, save to every man his wife and his children, that they may lead them away and depart. Here the ones who went the whole way are saying, well, we did this great thing and they're not getting any of our stuff. We'll let them have their wife and kids so they can run off with them. But look at David, type of Christ to us. Then said David, you shall not do so, my brethren, with that which the Lord has given us, who has preserved us and delivered the company that came against us to our land. For who will hearken to you in this matter? But as his part is that goeth down to the battle, so shall his part be that tarries by the stuff. They shall part alike. And it was so from that day forward that he made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel unto this day. David's got the right perspective. He realizes the Lord has given us this battle. Okay, we didn't win anything, boys. 400 of us against all of them. God did all of this, and it's his stuff. And we're not going to play that game where, well, you didn't get to go, uh-uh. It's just as important that they guarded this stuff. Remember, the whole reason they were in this problem is because they were trusting in Ziklag, and they didn't leave anybody to guard the stuff the first time. Now they've left some people to take care of the things they couldn't carry with them. They're going to partake. And, you know, there's a great parable or a great lesson for us as far as the kingdom goes, because different people are called to different parts in the body. Some people get to be the head or get to be the mouth. Other people get to be the foot stuck in a shoe. And in even within our families, you know, I have a role here at this church where I come up here and teach. And that role frequently requires that my wife stays home with the stuff. I have four little stuffs. And if I, you know, do the greatest job in the world with this church, and those four little stuffs go to hell because they get left behind because my wife and I are both tending to this flock, if we're not ruling that one right, what have we done? Nothing. It says in Matthew chapter 10, verse 41, it says, he that receives a prophet in the name of a prophet shall receive a prophet's reward. He that receives a righteous man in the name of a righteous man shall receive a righteous man's reward. The way it works within your body is my hand is the one that feeds my face, and my face is the thing that sucks down the food. My feet still benefit. You know, they still do. And, you know, some of us, our role is to pray. Because if that doesn't happen, then nothing happens. Like John Wesley said, we need prayer. And I hope that you guys are praying. There's people among you who have the gift of prayer, and you're praying while you're keeping track of your little wild broods, or you're doing whatever job it is you do. There are people whose responsibility is to give. They've been given a job. They've been given an opportunity to be generous with their money. You know, missionaries go out, and they go to the front line, but the people and stay behind and support the missionaries get the missionaries' reward. David says, no, it's not going to be that way. It's going to be a statute and an ordinance for Israel unto this day. And, you know, truth is, we are all the 200 weak people that couldn't go on. You know, that's who we are. The cool thing is, when we get into the next book, in chapter 2, verse 3 of 2 Samuel, it says this. When David is going up to Hebron, and he's getting ready to be king. And his men that were with him did David bring up, every man with his household. And they dwelt in the cities of Hebron. All 600 go. You know, Jesus made a promise to us. in John 6:39, and this is my Father's will which has sent me, that all of which he hath given me I should lose nothing, but should raise it up again at the last day. And this is the will of him that sent me, that everyone who seeth the Son and believeth on him may have everlasting life, and I will raise him up on the last day. We have a promise that our King is going to conquer, he's going to win, and then he's going to bring us along, and we're going to share, even though he does all the work. And it's really a pretty good program, because he gives us whatever gifts we need to do the work, and then we get credit for doing the work that he really does for us. And so, David, no, they're going to share in. And when David came to Ziklag, he sent of the spoil unto the elders of Judah, even to his friends, saying, Behold, a present for you of the spoil of the enemies of the Lord. To them which were in Bethel, and to them which were in Ramoth, and to them which were in Jatir, and to them which were in Aror, and to them which were in Siphmoth. What a great name for a town. Where do you live? Siphmoth. To them which were in Eshtemoa, to them which were in Rakal, to them which were in the cities of the Jerahmeelites, and to them which were in the cities of the Kenites, and to them which were in Hormah, to them which were in Korishan, and to them which were in Athach, and to them which were in Hebron, and all the places where David himself and his men were wont to haunt. Wont to haunt. Say that fast a few times. Wont to haunt. David took of all the stuff. They had so much. All the guys got their stuff back. But these Amalekites had been raiding all over the place. They'd been raiding in Israel. They'd been raiding other countries outside. And so they had so much stuff. David took it. They had spoil. They got extra stuff out of the deal. And they sent them to all of the other people around where David used to hang out. So, you know, shared from the abundance. And when he gets ready to be made king, there's going to be a whole bunch of people who remember David's name. Now, chapter 31, short chapter. And again, contrast Saul with David, how he ends up the book of 1 Samuel. Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell down slain in Mount Gilboa. In 1 Samuel chapter 28, verse 4, as they were getting ready to fight, it said, The Philistines assembled and came and encamped at Shunem, and Saul gathered all Israel, and they encamped at Gilboa. And when Saul saw the armies of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly. David's afraid, he seeks the Lord. Saul's afraid, he goes to a witch. That's kind of what happened. So they're set up over here in Gilboa. The Philistines are set up over here in Shunem. They go fighting, and it's so bad that it says here in verse 1, they fell down slain in Mount Gilboa. They were driven back to their own camp. They were just completely routed. And the Philistines followed hard upon Saul and upon his sons. And the Philistines slew Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, Saul's sons. And Saul is responsible for this. I mean, Jonathan, great guy, loved David, but it's Saul's fault. His rebellion, his problems were causing the death of his children. And, you know, look, there is the hand of the Lord in this. I mean, it would have been great if Jonathan could have hung around and lived through this to support David. He would have laid his crown down. But the other children wouldn't have, not necessarily. In fact, when we get into 2 Samuel, there's going to be Ishbosheth, who is a remaining son of Saul, and he's going to fight and try to keep the crown, and it's going to be nasty. So they need to get Saul's line out of the way so that David can have a clear path to the throne. And the battle went sore against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he was sore wounded of the archers. He's mortally wounded. It's going bad. They're approaching him. Of course, Saul would be in the back. And they let loose with the archers. The archers hit him, presumably with more than one arrow. He was sore wounded, mortally wounded. Then said Saul to his armor bearer, Draw thy sword and thrust me through therewith, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and abuse me. But his armor bearer would not, for he was sore afraid. Therefore Saul took a sword and fell upon it. And when his armor-bearer saw that Saul was dead, he fell likewise upon his sword and died with him. So Saul died, and his three sons, and his armor-bearer, and all his men the same day together, just like that vision of Samuel had prophesied. So what do you do with this? Saul kills himself. It's funny, he's got an armor-bearer with him, and his armor-bearer won't do it. Saul's paranoid, his whole kingship, he's thinking, people are out to get me, David's out to get me, everybody wants to get me. Nobody but Saul will raise a hand against Saul. The armor bearer won't even do it when he's mortally wounded. The question is, Saul is mortally wounded, is it really committing suicide? I mean, he was going to die anyways, right? Surely he had the right to just do that because he was afraid. You know, if I stay here alive, they're right there. They're going to come up. They're going to take me, and they're going to torture me, and they're going to do horrible things to me, and just kill me now. Kill me now. The problem is that's always wrong. We don't have that liberty. We don't have the liberty to take a life. We don't have the liberty to take our own life. It's God's. Jesus said, John 10:10, the thief comes to steal, kill, and destroy. I am come that they may have life. Satan's always that way. What did he tempt Jesus with? Throw yourself down. God will catch you up. You know, that little whisper. It's better if you be dead. And it's not sin to be that miserable. It's not. Sometimes life makes you that miserable, even as a Christian. Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 8, he says, "For we would not, brethren, have you ignorant." I don't want you to be mistaken at all about our trouble which came to us in Asia, that we were pressed out of measure, above strength, he says, insomuch that we despaired even of life. It was so horrible I wanted to die. He keeps going, though, and he says, "But we had the sentence of death in ourselves, that we should not trust in ourselves, but in God which raises the dead, who delivered us from so great a death, and doth deliver, in whom we trust that he will yet deliver us." Saul knew his time was limited. He had been told by Samuel, he had 20 years. Maybe he figured, I got 20 years on this happen. It's probably not going to happen. But he had been told yesterday by whatever that, through the witch, Samuel thing, whatever happened there, tomorrow. Tomorrow's your day. You ever think about that? What would I do if I knew tomorrow was my day? Who would you call? What would you spend your last night doing? Would you surf the internet? Would you, would you watch TV Land? You know, before I die, I just want to see Cosby Show one more time. If I could just see the, what would you do if it was your last day? Well, he doesn't get right with God, and he knows he's separated from God. He didn't act on it. Saul is scared. He knows he's wounded bad. He's afraid what they're going to do with him. And he thinks, I want to stop the pain right now. I'm hurt bad. I want to stop the pain. I don't want it to get worse. Problem is, it's a lie. Because it doesn't. If you leave the planet separated from God, the pain doesn't stop. It just becomes permanent. That's the way it is. And I'm not saying that suicide is an unforgivable sin. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is, if you're not a Christian when you die, Jesus says, I am the way, the truth. No one comes to the Father but by me. If you leave the planet without being a Christian, and, how many people are ripped off thinking that this pain will go away. I'm tired of feeling this way. And it's, the truth is usually very few people commit suicide because they're in horrible physical pain. It's emotional pain. And yet we read Jesus talks about Lazarus and the rich man, and the rich man dies and wakes up, and he's in torment. Pain just starts for him, and only now he's got a body that can take the pain. And, there is a right way to commit suicide. If you're going to commit suicide, Paul gives us the steps in Galatians 2:20. He says, I'm crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live. Yet not I, but Christ lives in me. In the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. If your life, if yourself, if your internal struggle is causing you so much pain, you just wish it would die, good, kill it. Put it to death. Say, okay, it's yours. Dead. Gone. I have no will. Give me your will. I'll do your will. No, you can live in me, and I will just be yours completely. I mean, it's about finding the right master, and that's the way to do it. Look what happens after Saul kills himself. When the men of Israel that were on the other side of the valley, and they that were on the other side of Jordan, saw that the men of Israel fled, and that Saul and his sons were dead, they forsook the cities and fled, and the Philistines came and dwelt in them. They had gone all the way to the Jordan, and even on the other side, they had, because of Saul's sin, Israel was now cut in half. The Philistines had made a path right through the middle by one guy's sin. But look, verse 8. And it came to pass on the morrow that the Philistines came to strip the slain, and they found Saul and his three sons fallen in Mount Gilboa. Kill me now, because they're going to catch me, they're going to take me, they're going to abuse me, they're going to torture me. I got to die right now. Kill me now. Guy's like, I'm not touching you. You're the king. There's no way I'm going to kill the king. Well, I'll kill myself. Take his own life. The Philistines don't show up for another day. I think it was a lie.
It was a lie of the enemy from the very beginning that this is it. If you don't kill yourself now, you're going to be taken and abused. No, he had another day at least before they even showed up. Who knows? I mean, I personally think that Saul had every opportunity to repent right up to the very end. And yet he wouldn't do it. So look what happens to him. They cut off his head and they stripped off his armor and sent into the land of the Philistines round about to publish it in the house of their idols and among the people. And they put his armor in the house of Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Beth-shan. In 1 Chronicles, the parallel account, chapter 10, verse 9, it says, "And when they had stripped him, they took his head and his armor, and they sent into the land of the Philistines round about to carry tidings unto their idols and to the people. And they put his armor in the house of their gods, and they fastened his head in the temple of Dagon." They actually had his head mounted in there because they looked at it like, well, we just beat your king, so obviously our God is stronger than your God. Here is our trophy of war. We've got the head of the king of whatever, so Dagon is more powerful than, you know. And, you know, no, it means that Saul was disobedient and sinful. The very thing that he feared. They're going to abuse me horribly. Can't get much more abused horribly than that from where I'm sitting, is have your head mounted in one place and your body, you know, stripped and hung naked on a wall somewhere else. Sad. "And when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard of that which the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and went all night, took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Beth-shan, and came to Jabesh and burnt them there. And they took their bones and buried them under a tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days." Jabesh-Gilead, if you remember back in 1 Samuel chapter 11, they were being attacked, and Saul said, "We're going to rescue him back." When he was still godly Saul, when the Spirit was still on him, he gets holy anger. He sends to all the tribes and says, "We're going to go take care of them." And he rescued them 20 plus years ago. Now they hear what happened to him, and that even though he was fallen horribly, still was Israel's king, and they said, "No, we're going to go get him and bring him down." It's funny, I was, I don't know if you follow the news this week. It's weird what makes the news if you follow the internet news. And there's been a story that on one of the news sites that I go to for a couple days now, where somewhere, I think it was Tennessee, a pastor of some Baptist church got arrested. Did you see that? They found him. He was drunk and wearing a skirt, urinating outside of a daycare center, and the cops came and there was booze and OxyContin and some other stuff in his car, and he made some very poor remarks to the officers at the time. Somehow, now, and yes, it was stupid. I gotta think, knowing the averages in our nation of 250 million people, he probably wasn't the only person who got arrested for being drunk and disorderly and lewd in public. But he was pastor of a church. So pastor of a church, he makes the front page for a couple of days anyways, because he should have been different. And then he blew it. So we got to put that out there for everybody. And, you know, the guy says he doesn't remember anything. He couldn't believe that he would have said the things that they said that he said. And, you know, this guy was also on a radio station somewhere. And at first I'm thinking, loser. I mean, why look what you did. You're giving all these people the opportunity to blaspheme and say, "Yeah, those Christians are a bunch of hypocrites. Give them a few drinks and they're going to be wearing a skirt and peeing outside of a daycare center." You know, that's, and I'm thinking, why would you, you know, and I'm just wondering, like, oh, it's, you know. And then you realize, you know, I hope I'm never the guy that's drunk in a skirt outside the daycare center. I don't want, not that that's something that I've really been longing to do and I'm holding it back, you know, that's not the case, but Galatians chapter 6, verse 1 says this: "Brethren, if a man be overtaken in a fault, you which are spiritual, pin him down and tell everybody what a loser they are." No, it says, "You which are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of meekness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. Bear ye one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ." Saul died poorly. He failed miserably at the end. And yet, these guys, because of the way he had been before he fell, risked their life to go take him and give him some dignity on the way out. When we get into the next book, we're going to see David. David let it go. David mourned. He would not let anybody celebrate that Saul had died. He never raised his voice. He always trusted in God. I feel bad. I know within myself there is that desire sometimes to pounce on people when they blow it. But the truth is, but for the grace of God, there go you or I. So let me leave you with this. You who are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of meekness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. Let's be men and women who bear one another's burdens. Amen? Let's pray. Lord, thank you so much that you are faithful even when we're not. Lord, I don't know that pastor in Tennessee. God, I pray that you would heal, restore, Lord, that you would use that somehow to bring glory to yourself. Lord, and I pray for the people that we know in our lives who are blowing it or who have blown it. Lord, help us be not quick to point the finger. Lord, let us be all about trusting in you, about forgiveness, about restoration, about grace. Lord, we have been forgiven much. Help us to love much. I pray, Lord, that you would bless this congregation. In Jesus' name.